Access number 27783, Mr. Doug Ratcliffe, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Ratcliffe?
Yeah, I was born in Hampstead, London, 1923.
What was the actual date?
21/11/1923.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yeah, my mother and father. My father was First World War veteran and came back and worked in the railways all his life, and we lived in railway property in Hampstead. And my mother was a churchgoer, and we had a very big house, and she had the distressed area boys down from the north, and I grew up with these boys. You know, they all came down and they found different types of jobs. We even had one blind boy in there, you know, who was a marvellous pianist, and he used to do piano tuning.
So how long would they be down for?
Well, they would be they're down there for 2 or 3 years, and then they would find their own level again and go somewhere. And the friends we had in that area all related to the church, All Souls Church, which was a famous church there. Unfortunately, it's there no more. But everything was grouped around that particular theme of life. And I grew up in the church, so to speak, you know, 4 services a day, and that's Holy Communion in the morning, matins, afternoon service, and evensong, you know. And then right through the week, one would have all sorts of things, whist drives going on. So there was nothing new about life in those days, in the late 30s, of everything happened, seemed to happen around that particular area.
And the family were reasonably well off for the time, as your dad was in steady employment?
He was in steady employment. He was never out of work, but it was still hard going. You know, I mean, the thing is, there was... I don't know how much you got paid to take in a distressed area boy, but it's a full-time job for my mother. And I went to the church school. And
tell us a bit about your education. How did you do at school?
Well enough to get into what they called a central school. I left the small school, the church school, and went to Haverstock Central School, where that was another different type of school. Regimental, uniformed, disciplined, and full of sport. And I neglected maths for cricket. And fortunately the maths master was also the cricket master, so I got away with a lot, but I can't count. But it was a jolly good school. And
were there any subjects you liked or disliked? I mean, maths was obviously didn't like much, but I mean, what about the other subjects? Were there any you were particularly good at or bad at?
No, I don't think I was very good at all at any of them. It was just an ordinary level. But I recall that I left the school at 14 rather than stay on till 16.
So that'd be 1937.
Yeah, so I got a job.
Now, just before we go on, what about sport? How important was sport to you? Was it just cricket or was it other sports?
Just cricket. Yeah, just cricket.
Did you play for the school or outside?
I played for the school and later on for many other teams, okay? I think perhaps if it wasn't for the war and living next door to Lord's Cricket Ground, I would have gone into the profession.
You were that good, I mean.
Well, I got paid even though I was an amateur. There were certain matches where they wanted people of ability to play to back up. I think I could have made it into the... not in Test cricket, I think I'd have made a very good... league cricketer, you know, no, without any doubt at all.
And batting or bowling?
Batting, mostly. I opened, I was a left-hander, although I am right-handed, so that was an advantage. I threw with my, and bowled, third change, left arm round the wicket. When it needed to quieten things down, I was always brought on at many levels of the game. And I threw left-handed, played tennis right-handed. But there you go. it was a nice place to be left-handed, because the higher the game you went, the more accurate the bowling course. So you stemmed one side, and I thoroughly enjoyed the game, made a great study of it. And
did you watch it? I mean, did you spend a lot of time at Lord's as well?
All the time, you know. If there was any break, I would go to Lord's, even for an hour. And the knowledge that I had there, you know, and the people I knew, I very seldom paid in those days. Imagine what it costs now to go and watch. But it was not just to watch a game, to watch the training, and go over to Len Munster's little shop opposite Lord's Cricket Ground and talk with the professionals and see them choose their bats, and, you know, all that side of the game was deeply interesting to me.
Now, what job did you go to in 1937, back end of?
Went to the BBC.
And what work were you doing there?
I was what they call on the house superintendent staff, which gave you all sorts of jobs. They would be looking after the telephone foyer. You would do outside journeys to Ministry of Information, different areas. And then you would have conference jobs to stand guard outside of special conference. And the reason I got in there, my brother already worked there. So it was a good opportunity, and it was a marvellous job. Marvellous job.
And how long did you do that for?
Till we went to war. I stayed there.
Till 1939?
Yeah.
Now, were you
aware? No, not till... well after 39. I didn't come in to 1941.
Okay. Well, right. Now, before the war, I mean, were you aware of what was going on in Germany? Where did you get your information from? And what was your sort of view on the world situation, Germany, Hitler, the rest of it?
Once again from the church. Because the scouts and the ATC, this is a little, you know what the ATC is, of course, don't you? We joined that. And we all worked at the first crisis of preparing gas masks, preparing the usual things during a crisis. When that died down, you pulled out, you know, there was nothing for you to do. But obviously the powers that be knew that something else was cropping up at a later date.
Did you understand about Hitler? I mean,
You saw this happening, and you would hear the people who surrounded the church at that level, and that particular church carried a very high level. I remember the Samuel Ford, the vicar, was, I think he was the son of the Archdeacon of Armagh, and he would attract a lot of high-caliber people living in that area. And you would get a lot of information from them and hear a lot of things.
Now, you mentioned the Boy Scouts and the ATC Air Training Corps.
Tell
me about... You were in the Boy Scouts, were you?
Yes.
What sort of activities did you do with the Boy Scouts?
Just camping. General camping. You would have a lot of fun with the chaps, go out, camp around, go on hikes. Not very memorable to me. It was more memorable to be... get back and play cricket. So, you know, a weekend away for me would mean I wasn't playing cricket. So you lost out one way.
Well, yeah, some of the Boy Scouts were quite military in their backup, well, it was original intention. Was it a sort of military-edged one, or was it one that was more relaxed?
I think it had a military edge, because I remember the scout master, I met him later during the war. He was... intelligence officer. May not have been intelligence, but he was an adjutant, I think, at RAF Yatesbury, and I met him again. So probably this military thing came through the scoutmaster. I don't think all scout setups had that, but we were drilling and with the pole and fighting with that sort of thing.
Now, what about the Air Training Corps? When did you join that?
I joined that, I think, in 38. I'm not sure about that, because that was very short-lived.
Where was it based?
In Hampstead. Yeah, the Hampstead group. Very short-lived. I was a long time getting a uniform, which sort of depressed me. And once again, it stopped the impromptu games of cricket, because if there wasn't a game, we would make up a game and go to Primrose Hill and play. So anything that interrupted cricket or watching cricket was a bit of a chore. So,
what sort of activities were there with the air training corps? I mean, what were they doing?
You had a choice. My choice was, because I had no other abilities to do, was Morse code. So I remember I had a little diary and the Morse code, and that was it. And apart from that, that finished. I think I got a uniform, and I think I had a photograph taken in uniform, and that was the end of that.
So the training with Morse code, there was no buzzer or anything to practice with?
Oh, no.
It was just a matter of you sitting down and learning it?
Just a little diary. Had it in the diary, isn't
it? Did it test you?
Yeah, you got a little test.
And how were you at Morse code?
Pretty good.
So it was something you took to reasonably naturally?
Yeah,
because some people don't. They say it's like music.
Yeah.
So what about the outbreak of war? You'd be working at the BBC. Do you remember the day? It's a joke, I know, but do you remember the day war broke out? What happened to you, whether you heard the broadcast, what people thought?
Yeah, Sam Ford was in the pulpit, and the warning... We were in the vestry to start with, and one of the family of Samuel Ford came in, and they had talked about Chamberlain's. And a lady, I remember, was very distressed in there. And I thought, you know, what's this? So we left, the service started. The air raid warning sounded in the middle of the sermon. And Sam Ford asked everybody to kneel and pray. And he finished his sermon and we left the church. And we went home, and as you know, the all clear went after that. I remember that absolutely vividly, what happened in Belsize Road.
Now, how did you feel about the outbreak? Well, you'd be 16.
Yeah.
So prime age to be involved in a war, in that sense. I mean, did you think it would involve? Did you see it as a threat to you and your family?
Let me try and explain what happened at the BBC. The BBC already became a military force. There were doors in all the passageways that you can imagine going through a submarine. You had to step through it, and that could be clamped closed. Okay, that on the ground and lower ground floors. So the BBC became very military. Special passes. I remember I had a special pass for priority on travel. Although I was a junior messenger, you still got this. And you were issued with a civilian type gas mask. You know, there were two gas masks. There was a box and there was a drape gas mask where you had a heavy duty gas mask. It wasn't a military gas mask, but it was the in between. And you were issued with that. So slowly you became aware of what was going on.
Now, I should have asked earlier, you were at the BBC, is that White City then, or where would you...
No, British Broadcasting House.
Actual Broadcasting House?
BH, yeah.
And so what other effects, what effects did it have on your work? You know, obviously this gradual thing, but this gradual increase in security measures and precautions, what else happened?
Well, your job changed. There were more messages being taken, particularly to the Ministry of Information, which is University House, you know, in Store Street. Okay, so you would maybe do two or three journeys up there a day, taking data dispatches. And I remember seeing two men. One of them was a pilot called Smith from a Sunderland there, and two chaps were given the DFC in. And I stood there and watched this. So you became very aware of what was going on. You had very special reasons to understand war. I remember Quentin Reynolds. I remember Ed Murrow in the BBC, always charging in and out. And these chaps were open to discussion and talk with, and although they were high and mighty, they would just have a chat. And I remember sitting downstairs in the restaurant with Ben Lyon, and he's saying BB was not with him at the time, but sat at the same table with him down in the restaurant during the Blitz.
Now, what about the air raid precautions generally? You mentioned the gas mask, but what about, did you have at home, did you have an Anderson or any other type of shelter built?
Yeah, we had an Anderson in the back garden.
Now, who put that in? Was it you or the family that put it in, or what was it put in for you by the council?
I don't recall. I don't think, my father would have been capable of doing it, but I think it was put in by the council, I'm sure.
Now, what was it like, the Anderson shelter? Because I know everyone thinks they know, but actually very few people now have been in one, you know. What was it like in one of them, and did you actually use it?
Never. Wet. That's what I remember. I think we got into it, and my mother, I realised she would never go into it. Not because of anything regarding the Anderson shelter or the discomfort, because of her beliefs.
What way?
She wouldn't. She was a very religious lady, and I think she would leave everything to the Almighty. That was it. She wouldn't go in it. So that meant nobody went. And we had a big house, and I remember there was a wine cellar there, where it was a bit of fun going in there to sleep. But we soon got fed up with that.
Now, what about the blackout? Was the blackout enforced in your house?
Oh, yeah. Oh, everywhere.
How did they do it? Actually, physically, a big house, how did you blackout it all out?
Well, it's an old house, and upstairs they had big wooden shutters that came across that were never, ever used, you know, and then suddenly war comes and you can pull these shutters across, you know. And I remember the hinges had to be oiled because they've never been used. But downstairs you had the usual paper, strip paper, sticky paper. Everybody started to put sticky paper across because they told us that, you know, if there was a bomb blast, that it would hold the fractured glass, which was nonsense. But everybody did it, you know.
Was it black paper or
anything you could get hold of, generally brown sticky paper, which was lickable. There was no adhesive, you know. I mean, you had to wet it horrible. And having got it on there, getting it off when they realised it was a bit of a nonsense was worse. But there you are, that's what was used.
Now, what about rationing? Because that came in pretty early, didn't it? But did you recall the impact of food and clothing rationing on you?
No.
So that was
not
something you noticed?
No, not at all, no.
Now, anything about during the phony war, anything change or happened that you recall that we've not mentioned?
No, only that the BBC never relaxed. They had their own fire service there, their own roof spotters. They had a series of disabled men who would take messages around London by private car or taxi. They had the Maida Vale Studios, Alexandra Palace. So this was linked up. Mostly the chaps who carried these were some ex-servicemen, some men. Some of them, I remember, Paddy, only had one arm, you know, but they used to deliver these messages and be called on to go out. And when the Blitz started...
And that would be September 40, would it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about the Blitz and how, you know, as far as you were concerned, both at work and at home?
Well, at home, at one period, I forget where it was, Sam Ford had lost his staff in Finchley Road. He had a very big house in Finchley Road. Okay, so we closed our house in Belsize Road, and the whole family, that's myself, mother and father, went to live in the vicarage. my brother had already been called up before the war, because he was in the VR before the war as a photographer. And we lived in the vicarage, all of us. So that is my first remember. That's the first part I remember of the war actually coming to London, where searchlights and few bombs were dropped, very few, before the big blitz started. And I then had an offer to work shift at, well, I think it wasn't an offer, I think it was a decision that they made to make a shift system at the end. And there were in Duchess Street, they had air raid houses specially reinforced for the staff who worked round the clock. And also in the concert hall, they had the whole of the concert hall in the BBC, they had mattresses where you could, if you stayed during the night, if there was an air raid warning. And most memorable night was, I was on duty when the bomb came into the BBC, which was a delayed action bomb. And there was a stick, so everything shook, and it wasn't till about 20 minutes later that it got down to where we were on the ground floor, that there was a bomb in the building. And Robilliard, who I knew, he was the chief fireman there, he went up and the bomb exploded. I think this was the moment Bruce Belfridge was reading the news, and the bomb exploded. And when I talk to people, some of the boys of the plaque inside BH, of the people who went to war and died, Robilliard's name's there. You know, he died in the BBC. It doesn't say that he did that, but his name is still on the board there. And that bomb went off there, and for some reason or other, they hadn't evacuated underneath, and I think six or seven ladies were killed. And I remember two or three days later, I came into the artist's foyer, and there they were laid out, covered, brought down.
How much damage was done to Broadcasting House by that bomb?
Well, quite a lot. It didn't stop them working. I don't know the details on that. I'm sure they exist somewhere. But
you didn't see the area of the explosion then?
No. Oh, yeah. You, as far as you could get up, you just have a look, you know, to see, but it was just a lot of rubble. I mean, the bomb went off inside the building, you know. And later on, another mine dropped outside the building. Once again, I was on duty. And it blew the whole front of... what's the hotel right opposite? Still there. The Duchess Hotel. Anyway, the big hotel opposite Broadcasting House. That was blown to pieces, with pieces, beds hanging out the windows, you know. So that was a mine that came down the side. But I think they had a marvellous warning system there, you know, chaps on the roof all night long.
Did you ever do any of that fire watching or fire spotting?
No.
Now, what about the bombs in Hampstead, Belsize Park, Hampstead?
Wasn't heavily hit. There was some, Broadhurst Gardens was hit one night, and there were bombs in Belsize Road, you know, but it wasn't like the East End where you had whole streets smashed down. There were bombs dropped.
Did it affect the public transport system a lot? I mean, or would you walk to work, or when it was? Or, I mean, were there still buses or tubes running, trains?
Yeah, relating to what's happening right now, I honestly don't remember any sort of problems of getting to work. I really don't. I used to travel down to Gatwick to see my brother, where he was stationed, by train, and seemed to be okay. And that was, you know, even during an air raid, something seemed to be running. Buses, of course, as you know, were blacked out. They had the headlights had special grills on. But I never found any problem. But that is perhaps youth, you know. You just, you go and you avoid it if you want, if you could travel by tube, because it was difficult getting on the platform. People were in the platform, particularly at Swiss Cottage. You know, I remember that was my station. And if you went down there, which I did once, to went with a friend of mine who came home from the Navy, and I think you had to walk over people if for the train to come in. They were right up to the edge, you know, special areas where you could walk, where they had to be. But that was the last time I went down. It wasn't a very pleasant thing to do.
Now, anything else happened before you were called up or volunteered? I'm not sure yet which you was. I mean, anything else happened in there?
Yeah, I had a friend called Bill Wright, who worked in the BBC, and we decided that we would join up. And I said the best thing we can do is join the Royal Marines, because I had seen a friend of mine, Ken Spurgeon, across the road, and he had a lovely red stripe down his blue trousers, and that was for us.
It was as simple as that, was it?
Oh, though? Yeah, yeah. And they didn't want to know. You know, I think we tried, and I think the Royal Navy, they wanted in for 12 years. Everybody knew the war was going to be over by Christmas, you know, that sort of attitude. And I think we then went to the Air Ministry, where once again they didn't want to know. And I was standing there with Bill Wright and said, so, what do you do? And Bill Wright said, we're at the BBC. And the chap said, wireless. And Bill said, I said, yes. Never forgotten that. Oh, he said, yes, okay. There was a forms, you know. So we went back, and I said, we'll be wireless operators, Bill. And Bill said, no, you know. I said, yes, this is great. He said, we don't know anything about wireless. I said, they must know all about wireless at the BBC. We'll find out. Nobody knew anything about wireless in the BBC. Not a thing. As for Morse code, they said the GPO did that, which they did, you see. So I had a feeling for the Morse code, and I helped Bill. And we eventually got called up.
So you volunteered and were then accepted and called up. And when were you called up then?
You join up and you have a deferred service till they call you. So that's 41, coming up to the end of 42. Okay.
Right.
Late 41, I think I went in.
You don't know the month?
No. I could give it to you at a later date, because I've got my record somewhere. But
okay, we'll get it off that next time. I'll fill it in the cataloguing so they can look in the cataloguing.
Yeah.